Welcome to the program, everyone. This is Connecting the Notes, and I'm your host, Matthew Ray. This hour, we will bring you part two of our two-part series on Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. Joining us once again is John French, longtime Magic Band drummer, and Gary Lucas, who played guitar for Beefheart and also managed the singer towards the end of his musical career. If you missed part one, you can log on to connectingthenotes.com to stream it online. Thanks for joining, and enjoy the show.
Come on down to the big dig. Come on down to the big dig. Come on to the big dig. Singing the Smithsonian Institute blues. Singing the Smithsonian Institute blues. The way it's going, the Brea Top Hits. I know you just can't lose. The new dinosaur is walking in the old one's shoes. Come on down to the big dig. Can't get around the big dig. This may be premature, but if I'm wrong, you can just say it's the first time I was happy to be confused. Singing the Smithsonian Institute blues. You new dinosaurs, now it's up to you to choose. Before your feet hit the tar, you better kick off them old shoes. And forget about that big dig. Now you see it, and it's up to you to choose. It sure looks funny for a new dinosaur to be in an old dinosaur shoes. Dinosaur shoes. Dinosaur shoes. Come on down to the big dig. You can't get around the big dig. Come on to the big dig. Can't get around the big dig. Singing the Smithsonian Institute blues.
Don Van Vliet, the voice of Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. The mysterious frontman created some of the most unique music of his time, combining a blend of blues, rock, and psychedelic music with bizarre lyrics and imagery. As one rock journalist justly described his music, this noise is like none other. Often overlooked was the Magic Band, the members of which had an enormous impact on the music, especially when it came to interpreting the vision and ideas of Don Van Vliet. Working with Beefheart had its challenges and his rewards. His temper was short and working conditions under him were not ideal. Beefheart would often recite tall tales for the press and often refused to give his talented band any credit for the music. Shortly we will be hearing more from former Magic Band members Gary Lucas and John French, learn more about Captain Beefheart, his time with Frank Zappa, his early 80s resurgence, and ultimately his exit from music.
Hop, 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 hop,
Give Me That Heart, Boy, recorded by Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band during the Mirror Man sessions. Before that, you heard Smithsonian Institute Blues from the Trout Mask replica follow-up, Lick My Decals Off, Baby. The music on Lick My Decals Off, Baby is similar to that on Trout Mask replica. The album remains out of print and much coveted among Beefheart fanatics. Beefheart parted ways with Zappa and Straight Records after the release of Lick My Decals Off, Baby. Van Vliet decided he wanted to return to basics with his music, and that the last two records were too far out. He released two records in 1972, The Spotlight Kid and Clear Spot. He defended this musical direction, saying his music was not being compromised. As he told Crawdaddy magazine in 1972, quote, "No, it's not a compromise. I got tired of scaring people with what I was doing. I mean, people were backing away. I realized that I had to give them something to hang their hat on. So I started working more of a beat into the music. It's more human that way. You know, I wrote 400 songs for this album?"
About 6 months after that show, to interview him for the radio station. I was the music director. And through the course of that interview, I bonded with him and met him when he came up to play a concert at the school. And I made a point of going to see him every time he was in the vicinity generally. So it was actually through a professional association that it came about initially.
Yeah.
But I was already an avid fan.
That was Gary Lucas talking about Don Van Vliet. Lucas went on to work with the Magic Band and eventually became Beefheart's manager. Beefheart's pair of 1972 records, Clear Spot and Spotlight Kid, are still considered a pair of Beefheart's finest albums. Although the music was more accessible than his previous records, it still didn't score Beefheart much more success. Maybe it was a pipe dream to think the raspy-voiced, far-out Beefheart could translate to a mass audience. Regardless, Beefheart tried in earnest on his next two records, the critically frowned upon Unconditionally Guaranteed and Blue Jeans and Moonbeams. The records paired Beefheart with new musicians and producers and tried to produce a more polished mainstream album. Don later denounced both the records. Here's Gary Lucas talking about these. Did you know him during the recording or release of Unconditionally Guaranteed and Blue Jeans and Moonbeams? And did he ever talk to you about those albums? And
yes, I mean, he was defensive, and actually, you know, in going back, the first one is a lot better than people give credit for. There's some good music on it. But, you know, his line at the time was, I've got a right to win a Grammy.
Right.
So, you know, I think he thought it would be a way forward, and he just found even as great a band as he had, and doing, you know, to me, like a very accessible music on the Clear Spot album, hadn't brought him to the level that he thought he deserved. So, you know, I think that they were just sort of, you know, rear guard actions on his part, and definitely, or a retrenchment in the direction that any of his fans who were rabid fans who'd come up with the really hardcore stuff could swallow. You know, nobody really, I don't think it won him many new fans, if any, and mainly alienated the old fans.
Right.
I think he realized that pretty early on, but he did what he, you know, felt he had to do at the time. So.
Drummer John French was not involved with these two records, though he did express desire for some financial success. Here he is talking with us about some of these goals. So were there any goals you had for working with Don and the Magic Band that maybe went unfulfilled?
Absolutely. I wanted to make money. I wanted to go on tour. Don didn't really want to tour that much. He just wanted to write music, and he was constantly writing. So even though he was a very talented guy, because of the fact that he was constantly writing, he never rehearsed. So the band, basically, as far as I'm concerned, was always a disappointment on the stage, because Don really didn't think in terms of appealing to an audience. His idea was, if they don't like it, fuck them. You know, basically that's what he used to say. And I kept saying, look, you know, you're a great blues singer. And he would actually go to rehearsal and sit with Elliot Ingber, who was Wayne Dio Fingerling, and Elliot started playing these blues songs that Don knew, and Don would sing like 20, 25 blues songs, just sitting with Elliot. And rather than us rehearsing, that's what would happen at rehearsal. And, you know, I went up to him, I approached him several times, and I said, you obviously enjoy doing this stuff. Why don't you record some of this stuff? Because people would buy this, and we'd make some money, you know. But he couldn't do that. He'd say, I can't do that old dead man's stuff, you know, that old dead man's music. So that was a goal of mine. You know, I wanted to become successful as a drummer financially, and I was never able to do that because of working with him. And once I got sort of pigeonholed into that Beefheart's weird drummer thing, there was really no other door open.
she looks at me. In her eyes I see the sea. I don't see what she sees in a man like me. She says she loves me. Her eyes, yeah, her eyes. Her eyes are a blue million miles.
Her Eyes Are a Blue Million Miles off of 1972's Clear Spot by Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. When it comes to the stories and myths about Captain Beefheart, it can be difficult to separate fact from fiction. Interviews had to be read with skepticism, as Beefheart would make far-out claims about his childhood, and often took credit for teaching the members of the Magic Band how to play their instrument. Here is drummer John French talking about this behavior, followed by guitarist Gary Lucas's take on Beefheart's tendency to bend the truth. And he would often tell tall tales, especially in interviews to the press. He'd say, you know, he didn't go to sleep for a year, and he, you know, dropped out of school when he was three. And these stories that are kind of tough to believe, although I talked to Gary Lucas, he told me there were strings of truth in these. Did he talk that way to his friends and his bandmates as well? Did he often, did he kind of mislead you guys or lie a lot? Or
yeah, he did. He was, in fact, I ran into a girl that he dated as a woman years later, you know, in the 80s, in the 80s, and she told me that he had been going to see a shrink when he was a kid because he was a pathological liar, and he lied constantly. He was constantly lying, and he'd rope us into, of course, he was lying to us constantly, so we didn't know what to believe, but when he would lie and we knew that it was a lie, sometimes he was so convincing that you almost started doubting your own memory. Like, for instance, he didn't go to sleep for a year. Well, the year that he was talking about was the year I joined the group. And when I would come over for rehearsal, he'd still be in bed, asleep. So so it was obvious that he didn't stay up for a year. What he did is he stayed up all night for a year. You know, and slept all day. That's what he did. But and sometimes in interviews, he'd wrote, you know, if I was standing next to him and somebody was interviewing him, he'd say, "I stayed up one time for a year. Isn't that right, John?" And then you're like, and at first I go, yeah, you know. And then after a while, I just started saying, you know, really, I don't remember. I just don't remember. So, you know, that way I didn't feel like I was just being complete, you know, minion.
Do you think he purposely put people on during interviews, especially, say, journalists or radio hosts? Because I heard, you know, multiple interviews where he claimed that he had never gone to school, saying, if you want to be a different fish, you got to leave the school.
Well, I think he was definitely out of the American school of tall tale tellers, you know, Mark Twain sense, you know, capable of telling whoppers, you know, with a straight face. And, you know, but so did Bob Dylan. And, you know, there's a great interview in Playboy with Dylan and Matt Hentoff, which is very funny to read now, but which is obviously distilled with, you know, misapprehension. It's just some, you know, bald-faced lying, but in a very humorous and delightful way, so that, you know, on a cursory reading, you'd think, oh, well, this is really can't be. And then you realize he's just having fun. And that was, you know, Don liked to play with people in that way. And some of it was not so playful, and that's why people laughed. I mean, we were closely involved at times. But, you know, it had its rewards, let's say. Some journalists were turned off by that approach. I knew an English journalist here in New York who just sat here in my house and refuted him and said, "You're telling me you were the best saxophone player in the world? Honestly, how can you say that, John Coltrane?" And he was like, "I'm as good as Coltrane." And he would just take that tack and, you know, work it to death. And, well, anyway. You know, either you went with the flow or you rejected it. But, you know, I was willing to go along with the ride for a long time. And anyway, there were kernels of truth in everything he said. He might not have stayed up for a year without sleep, but I saw him stay up for 4 or 5 days at a stretch without sleep, you know, as we know it.
Right.
He really had the capacity to, you know, drive himself to the limits and everybody else crazy who couldn't, you know, keep up with him. So.
Yeah, and actually, after reading through as many interviews as I have lately, he's not nearly as out there as I thought, as I perceived him before. I started reading his responses are articulate, they're very well thought out, and there is truth in it.
Well, he was quite a brilliant person, you know, and sometimes, though, the Beefheart persona got in the way because he felt he had to make himself more, you know, quote, far out, unquote, than he had to. But, you know, there was a show business element that kind of crept into it there. Hmm. Even though he was pretty anti-showbiz, showbiz as we know it.
Right. Also, some of the interviews he gave, he mentioned that he was the one that wrote all the music. You know, he made claims that he taught people how to play.
Yeah, I know. I think that was, you know, unfortunate, and I think that a lot of credit has to go to everybody who ever passed through the ranks and stuck it out for their contributions, musical and energy-wise. But I can tell you this, even though there are bits and passages I can claim authorship of, you know, and a few pieces, little things here and there.
Right, yeah, that was...
and other contributions other people made. Overwhelmingly, the overriding vision is Don Van Vliet. Without, you know, make no mistake about that. You know, there was a critic, Charles Shar Murray, who reviewed Doc at the radar station, and he had a line, "This noise is like no other." And that's a fact, and that was Beefheart's sound. And he is the architect of that, ultimately. You know, he was calling the shots as to what it ultimately sounded like as a sculptor of sound, even, you know, not being a trained musician, capable of writing the stuff down. And, you know, he was still able to generate incredible ensemble effects and, you know, author amazing melodies, even if he whistled them, you know, into a tape recorder.
Hmm.
And, you know, that nothing should be taken away from that. To me, he still stands as a towering figure in 20th century music whose influence is incalculable. I don't think there would have been a punk rock movement or a new wave movement as we know it without Beefheart. I think he's a progenitor and a prime mover of it.
Distant cousins, there's a limited supply, and we're down to the dozens, and this is why. Big-eyed beans from Venus, Oh my, oh my. Boys and girls, earth people around the circle, mixtures of man alike, big-eyed beings from Venus, don't let anything get in between us. Beam in on me, baby, and we'll beam together. I know we always been together, but there's more. Mr. Zoothorn Rollo, hit that long lunar note and let it flow. Let your wallets flop out and women open your purses. Cause a man or a woman without a big-eyed being from Venus is suffering with the waste. That's the case. Yeah, you're suffering with the waste. That's the case. Put them out in the sun. When the night comes, you don't have to go out and get them. They'll glow with you. They'll go with you. They'll shower with you. Ain't no losers, cause they're on the right track. Cause they're on the right track. You can be on the right track, woman. Of course, of course. Ain't no snafu, no fall to your wrong. Check these out. Beans from Venus. I'll let a few out. Let them pass in between us. Distant cousins, there's a limited supply. And we're down to the dozens. And this is why. Let anything get in between us. Big eyed beings from Venus. Big eyed beings from Venus.
Captain Beefheart with Big Eyed Beans from Venus. Thanks for listening to the show, everybody. This is Connecting the Notes. I'm your host, Matthew Ray. In this hour, we are exploring the music of Don Van Vliet, a.k.a. Captain Beefheart. This is part two of our two-part series. Former Magic Band drummer John French and guitarist Gary Lucas were kind enough to talk with the show, and you'll be hearing excerpts of our conversation over the course of this hour. The unique music of Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band was the result of a unique approach to writing the music. Here's Gary Lucas talking about Don Van Vliet's approach to composing. Did you ever witness Beefheart in the process of songwriting? Did he do that with, you know, while you
was
a private affair?
All the time. He'd just whistle and, Gary, listen to this. And it could be tuneless, actually. And then he would start singing, "It's the Stork in Pajamas." Some, you know, image that would always crack me up. Very surrealistic and humorous. And then, you know, sometimes he'd have you write it down. It was like, you know, you'd have this incredible flow of ideas. he couldn't turn it off. And he needed, you know, people around him sometimes to just get it down. He wasn't the most proficient writer of his own lyrics. And, you know, he couldn't remember a lot of his parts. He did a lot of this in the tape recorder. He carried a tape recorder, too. So, yeah, I saw him do that. And then I saw him arrange lots of pieces on the spot, just sort of, you know, intuitive arrangements, having people try different parts that he would come up with. And gradually a song would emerge out of it.
So how did he communicate these arrangements that he had to you and the rest of the band?
Well, a lot of it was verbal, you know, and a lot of it was through metaphor, too. I mean, he'd say, you know, play like you died. Before I played my solo piece, Labor Bud Living, on the Dock at the Radar Station album on version. You know, what does that mean? Or play like you're balancing a bowl of red Jell-O in one hand. They were just humorous quips that would, you know, goad you into trying to achieve what he was driving at. Sometimes he was a lot more specific, obviously, too. So there was a combination of that and demonstration. He sometimes would get on your instrument and try and show you, even though he was still pretty much untutored on his instrument. Sometimes it was he would play piano. You know, you had to follow him around with a tape recorder. He would whistle parts, scat sing parts, whatever it took to just sort of get his way and, you know, make his vision manifest.
And a lot of times he'd whistle, too. He had a great, great whistler. He could whistle in his throat while he was smoking a cigarette. He'd be smoking a cigarette, he'd have a cigarette in his lips, and he'd be whistling at the same time. Try this. You know.
You hardly know a day goes by in the cardboard cutout sundown. The moon popped up like a gallery duck, sipped up gold from the sunny cup, and Longhorn sawed the buggy grass, and the cowboy blew a harp sitting on his chapped ass, and the prairie flowers didn't look a bit queer, and the stars struck the sand, cartwheeled and poked in the prairie. A cactus juice stand, the only place the crows couldn't land. The bluebottle flies were as big as the cowboy's eyes, and their buzz was as loud as rattlers. A fire engine red whistle blows raspberries in a cloud of whipped steam. A tumbleweed ran out black patent yarn stink bug hoops from above a living male driving dot in perfect sympathy with the cardboard cutout sundown. You hardly know a day goes by in the cardboard cutout sundown.
Captain Beefheart with Cardboard Cutout Sundown. That song featured the guitar work of Gary Lucas, who joined the Magic Band in 1980. He implemented a musical theory called the Exploding Note Theory on that song and several other Beefheart songs. Here he is talking about the approach, followed by the piece Flavor Bud Living, performed by Lucas on the Captain Beefheart album Dock at the Radar Station. Can you explain the exploding note theory that you used with?
Yeah, well, you know, he had a theory that the best effect to achieve in playing his music was to play as if each note in a sequence had no relation to the previous note or the subsequent note. And what would that sound like? Well, I guess a very staccato attack. Like, you know, I've said bombs bursting in air, like ack-ack, you know. And I applied it to the recording of Evening Bell, particularly in Saved by Living, the solo piece, is also what I played on a piece called Cardboard Cutouts on the Ice Cream for Crow record, where I'm just ripping right through these very elaborated, learned, memorized passages, but using a very fragmentary kind of attack to just make everything seem, you know, startling. It's hard to, I could demonstrate it better than talk about it.
Willie the Pimp by Frank Zappa off his 1969 record Hot Rats. That song featured Captain Beefheart on vocals and was recorded at a time when Zappa and Van Vliet were good friends. At the time, Beefheart was signed with Zappa's Straight Records, and it was Zappa who allowed Van Vliet complete control over the album Trout Mask Replica. Beefheart and Zappa parted ways after the release of Trout Mask's follow-up Lick My Decals Off Baby, but in 1975, Van Vliet, discouraged with the two records released the previous year and unable to record or perform under his name due to contractual obligations, joined Zappa for a 1975 concert tour. Beefheart and Zappa, childhood friends, had a rocky relationship following Trout Mask Replica, and their relationship did not improve over the course of the tour. The two barely spoke, and as the story goes, much of Beefheart's stage time was spent sitting in a chair doodling caricatures of Frank Zappa. The short tour was documented on the album Bongo Fury in 1975.
While we're at it, we have a sort of a cowboy song we'd like to do for you. This is a song that deals with the rapidly approaching 200th birthday of the United States of America. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a song that warns you in advance that next year everybody is going to try and sell you things that maybe you shouldn't ought to buy. And not only that, they've been planning it for years. The name of this song is, pardon me, Poofter's Froth, Wyoming, Plans Ahead.
Poofter's Froth, Wyoming, about to live in 67. Take a letter, miss a better, and our pigeons will be homing. To our jobbers in Dakota and to Merwin, Minnesota, this is merely just a no-name by performance to our quota. Well, we've all come out to show them, and the hills have helped us load them. Little packets full of jackets, little rackets, little rackets, little Poofter Froth appointments, little Poofter Froth anointments, little hoods, little goods, little doodads from the woods. The entire stock is shipping, oh, our shot is hardly slipping to our markets of the world. T-shirts, rats, rubber snacks, poster rolls with matching tags. Yes, a special beer for sports, and paper cups that hold two claws. Trash compactors, small reactors, mowers, blowers, throwers, and the glowers. Yes, a bicentennial salute. 200 years have gone kaput. Ah, but we have been astute. Sign the non wild galoo.
Frank Zappa with Poofter's Froth, Wyoming, Plans Ahead, performed live and featuring Captain Beefheart on vocals. Beefheart and Zappa split for good at the conclusion of this tour. It wasn't until 1978 that Beefheart appeared again, this time with a new group of musicians and without the mainstream rock formula that plagued his previous two releases. He would end his musical career with three solid albums, Bat Chain Puller in 1978, Dock at the Radar Station in 1980, and Ice Cream for Crow, released in 1982. Although Mark Boston, Bill Harkleroad, Jeff Cotton, Victor Hayden, and other Beefheart mainstays were no longer playing in the group, John French did appear on 1980's Dock at the Radar Station. It wasn't uncommon for Magic Band members to leave the group and come back multiple times. Beefheart's abusive behavior towards his bandmates often drew them away, and the special music that resulted often drew them back in. Here's drummer John French talking about this relationship. You left the Magic Band and came back several times. What was it that kept bringing you back?
Well, after the original, you know, my original tenure, which was from Save His Milk to Trout Mess Replica, I had become so sort of indoctrinated. And, you know, there were a lot of things about Don that I liked. I found him a very fascinating person. And he was definitely very intelligent, very creative. But I found, after that 3 years of almost indoctrination, that I was more used to that environment than I was the outside world. And the outside world seemed really boring and bleak after being in this situation, even though the situation was also bleak, but in a different way. It definitely wasn't boring. I would say that the main reason that I came back is probably because it's sort of like the abused spouse syndrome, you know, where the woman gets beat up by her husband, but she keeps going back to him because she misses it.
A young Gary Lucas became Beefheart's manager in the early 80s. Here's Lucas reflecting on this period of time.
And you actually managed him for a brief period, and
yeah,
you were,
well,
how old were
not
you?
So brief, about 4 years. That's right. First couple of years with my ex-wife, now Ling Lucas, and then I picked up the reins when she and I split up for the last album, Ice Cream for Crow. What was that like? It was, you know, it was not a lot of fun at times. And it could be very stressful and difficult, but I was on a mission, you know. I really was more involved in trying to just spread the gospel and get him better known. Out of a sense of a miscarriage of justice on the part of the world at large, and not really recognizing en masse his genius. Not really in there for monetary sake or remuneration at all. Or I would have done something else, but I can tell you.
The music video he made for
Ice
Cream for Crow, that was largely something you came up with, or
how did you
enjoy that?
No,
process?
But I was, you know, the midwife of it, because how it came about was when we were recording Ice Cream for Crow, I talked to him about touring, and he was like, I really do not want to tour anymore. I had it with the last tour. That was his attitude. He just hated going out there live at that point, even though he was so good at times, you know, brilliant. So I said, well, there's this new channel, you know, that started up, MTV, and he knew about that a little bit, so he looked into it. And I talked him into making a video in lieu of going out to do live, you know, promotion for the record. And he right away started firing out great surrealistic stream of imagery, ideas, some of which made it into the video, some were impossible to achieve. And then I arranged, through pretty much begging both Epic Records and Virgin Records for a budget, and they went in 50-50 and contributed, I guess it was a $5,000 video. It was incredibly picky in budget. And I called in every favor in the book and lined up top people, editors, and the director was a great cinematographer, Daniel Pearl, who had done the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, was the DP. So with all these elements together, we got a great video, which is in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art, and has inspired a lot of other films, including the beginning of The Big Lebowski, if you see it, the whole image is derived, I would say, directly from Ice Cream for Crow.
In fact, they
pay tribute to Beefheart because there's a, you know, they use Her Eyes Are a Blue Million Miles from the Clear Stud album as a, you know, musical cue in the film under Jeff Bridges, I think, at one point early on in the film.
It's so hot, looks like you have 3 weeks cold. The moon's so full, why hang on a pumpkin? You know there's something. The moon was a stone's throw. Stop the show. I need to say hello to the crow.
Like the fire piano.
The moon showed up and it started the show. Tonight there'd be ice cream. Ice cream for Crow. Ice cream by night.
crow dance a panther. Scarecrow, you answer. You can he and haw, laugh and scratch. Ha ha ha. Shake my hand, give me a call. Two tears in a haystack. Scarecrow, get back. Tonight there'd be a feather treatment. Beneath the symbol, we'll all assemble. Oh, how we fly. Oh, how we tremble. Cut the cake. We'll all get well. Turn up the speakers. A keeper, ice cream for show. Oh, ice cream for clothes. Now, now, now. That's it. Now you can go.
Ice Cream for Crow, the title cut off of Beefheart's last record released in 1982. Don left music after this album to focus his attention on painting, a longtime love affair of his. His earliest artistic expressions came in the form of sculpting. On December 17, 2010, Don Van Vliet passed away from complications from multiple sclerosis. He was 69 years old. Gary Lucas released a statement following Van Vliet's death. Part of it read, "I never met anyone remotely like him in my 30 years in this business of music. He made up his own rules, was sue-eyed generous, and sounded like no one else. Steeped in gut-bucket blues and free jazz, Van Vliet operated on the highest of artistic and poetic levels that left most people bewildered and scratching their heads. But if you were willing to put in the work and really listen, his music was not a background experience, you would be rewarded with a searingly honest beauty and a breathtaking complexity that made most other efforts in the pop arena seem cheap and disposable." The Michael Werner Gallery in New York, which represented Beefheart's paintings, also released a statement. It read, "Don Van Vliet was a complex and influential figure in the visual and performing arts. He is perhaps best known as the incomparable Captain Beefheart, who, together with his magic band, rose to prominence in the 1960s with a totally unique style of blues-inspired experimental rock and roll. This would ultimately secure Van Vliet's place in music history as one of the most original recording artists of his time. After 2 decades in the spotlight as an avant-garde composer and performer, Van Vliet retired from performing to devote himself wholeheartedly to painting and drawing. Like his music, Van Vliet's lush paintings are the product of a truly rare and unique vision." As Simpsons creator Matt Groening wrote for Guardian in 2003, "Don Van Vliet, also known as Captain Beefheart, created an entirely original music by grafting the unsentimental blues growlings of Howlin' Wolf and Son House to the stringent performing demands of Igor Stravinsky, Ornette Coleman, and Van Vliet's high school pal and collaborator, Frank Zappa. Beginning in 1966 with his debut album Safe as Milk, and continuing through his last LP, 1982's Ice Cream for Crow, Captain Beefheart delivered an eccentric alternative to the rhythmically repetitious pop music of the day, and he did it with passion, virtuosity, and deadpan surrealistic brilliance." Thank you all for tuning in this hour. My name is Matthew Ray. This program is Connecting the Notes. A big thank you to John French and Gary Lucas for taking the time to talk with the show this past month. French recently published a book called Looking Through the Eyes of Magic about his time with Beefheart, and Gary Lucas puts on occasional Beefheart symposiums and is also a very active musician who is recording and touring constantly.
You wanna do what? You wanna do what? told you what, I told you what. Do what I do what, do what I do what. I told you what, I told you what. Go to school, go to school, go to school, go to school. Just came, just came, just came, just came.
Someone you've kept in touch with over
the
years?
No, I really had a parting of the ways in 84, but prefer to remember all the great times. There's like some people I don't see a point in having ongoing relationships after a certain, you know, coming to a crossroads, and he was one of them.
Yeah.
But I don't harbor any ill feelings or animosity, and I miss him a lot, but I just think it's better to keep my distance.